Rick Allen Ross is a cult deprogrammer. He has helped over 500 people escape from cults and has founded the Cult Education Institute. This is Rick Allen Ross. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
All right, we're recording. Rick Allen Ross, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on.
I made sure to include the Allen between your first and last name, because as I'm sure you know, you share a name with a very famous rapper. I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse for you, or something you're aware of.
It's okay. I mean, he used to be a prison guard, and his name wasn't originally Rick Ross. But when he changed it and became famous, I owned rickross.com at one time. And in fact, the Cult Education Institute website, which is now culteducation.com, was originally rickross.com. And I had to lose that because of the rapper and all the traffic that was coming that had nothing to do with my database.
Well, but you got to sell that to him, right?
No, actually, he made an offer, and he was kind of, shall we say, cheap. And someone else came along and bought it for more than his offer.
Wow. That's a sticky situation. You'd think you'd want to pay, you know, at least enough to get the domain name. Anyway, I didn't want to talk to you because you have Rick Ross's name in common with yourself. I wanted to talk to you because you have a very unique job, which is, as I understand it, you are a cult deprogrammer. You take people who have been in cults and you sort of unbrainwash them. My first reaction is like, how does someone even get involved in doing that? That is so out of, like, there's no career path that easily glides into that. How did you start doing this?
Well, I became involved in the whole thing because of a family situation. My grandmother lived in a nursing home that was covertly infiltrated by a fringe religious group that targeted the elderly. They encouraged their members to get jobs on the nursing staff, in particular nurses' aides. And my grandmother was targeted, but other than upsetting her, they certainly didn't recruit her. But when I found out about it, I became a community activist and organizer, and I started to work on committees and so forth, and then worked for a social service agency and an educational bureau, and that led me to have families bringing their loved ones to our offices and at Jewish Family and Children's Service in Phoenix. And they would say, look, I think my son, my daughter is brainwashed. Can you help me? And they were involved in any number of groups. And I started to do my work as without any formal training, because there certainly wasn't a school for culty programmers, as I was later called. And to date, I have done more than 500 interventions in almost every state in the United States and quite a few countries internationally.
Are there any states in particular that are ripe with cults?
Oh, I would say California, New York, where you have a lot of people and a lot of money, it attracts these groups. Also, there are states like Wyoming, New Mexico, and Texas that have wide open spaces where groups can set up compounds. There are groups that have set up compounds in Arizona and Utah. So I think urban areas attract these groups, but then at times they can isolate out in the middle of nowhere because they want to encapsulate and control the environment around their people.
Right. Yeah, I guess that makes sense that, you know, anywhere you have a high population, there's just bound to be a greater percentage of cults because there's more people. But so what were you, when you talk about this cult that infiltrated a nursing home, I mean, it almost sounds like a comedy bit. It sounds so surreal that they would target the elderly, but it happened. What is the mindset there? Are they trying to get money? Are they just true believers who want more followers? I don't understand why people would do that.
Well, when I dug into the group, they had received large donations from elderly people through wills, estates. The group was called, I think they've changed their name. They were called Jewish Voice Broadcast, and they saw their mission as targeting Jews to convert them to fundamentalist Christianity, and their particular flavor was Pentecostalism. And it was founded by a guy by the name of Lewis Kaplan, who was an ex-Jew, and he had become a Pentecostal Assemblies of God minister, and he created this ministry, as I say, to target Jews. My grandmother's nursing home was a Jewish nursing home, and I had no problem with them preaching what they believe and sharing their faith. What I had a problem with was covertly coming into the nursing home with an agenda, not openly in an honest way. And so that really was would rub me the wrong way. And also the idea of targeting one particular religious group with special focus, I think it really kind of had anti-Semitic implications. My grandmother spoke Yiddish as a first language, which is a German dialect spoken by Jews in Europe. And she came to this country as a refugee in 1906 to escape anti-Semitism and pogroms, which were orchestrated attacks by anti-Semites against Jews in Eastern Europe. And so I thought it was particularly terrible that at her age, she was 82 at the time, that she should be harassed by people that really disrespected who she was and her faith.
And what were you doing up to this point? Like, what was your day job?
My day job was working with my cousin who owned a large auto wrecking yard in Arizona, one of the largest. And basically, I would rebuild cars. We would scrap out cars and sell auto parts. And we had a warehouse. And so that really was my job. And I loved cars. And I loved working with my cousin. And this kind of happened very serendipitously. It was something that I never anticipated. But since my early days as a culty programmer, my work, of course, has evolved and changed. I'm the author of a book, Cults Inside Out, which has been published in Italian and Chinese as well as English. And I also have testified as a court expert in 10 states, including United States federal court. And I lecture at the university and college level. I've lectured at 30 universities and colleges in the United States and Asia.
Wow. So let's get into like the what kinds of you mentioned the fact that they were targeting the elderly. The kinds of people who get sucked up in cults. I think the main narrative that gets out there is that these people are vulnerable or they're lost souls, and that kind of just makes it very they're ripe to be brainwashed. Are there any narratives that are getting left out there, or is that the main thrust of the sorts of people that cults recruit?
Duncan, I don't really think that nails it. I think that we would like to think that. I mean, there's a part of us that is very unsettled by the fragility of the human mind and how vulnerable we all are to persuasion techniques, to cons, to scams. We all are. There would be no advertising or political ads if it wasn't for the fact that we are all susceptible to persuasion. And what destructive cults do is they focus like a laser those coercive persuasion techniques, thought reform techniques, in order to trick and trap people. And I'll be honest with you, I think it could happen to anyone, given the right set of circumstances. Among the hundreds of people that I've done interventions to bring out of destructive cults, I've worked with 5 medical doctors who were under undue influence. One was an orthopedic surgeon, another was an anesthesiologist. I also did an intervention to help a clinical psychologist get out of a very abusive, controlling relationship that her family could not understand how she became so entrapped and convinced. So I have seen people very sophisticated, very well educated, get trapped by these groups we call cults. And I would say that a lot of times it's somebody that we really trust who approaches us. It could be a family member. It could be a romantic interest. It could be an old friend who looks us up. Someone that we care about, that we value their judgment, and they persuade us to get involved in a group. And of course, none of us are told initially, I mean, people who enter into a group, none of them are told, well, you know, we're a destructive cult. We're a cult. They don't even acknowledge many times what their real agenda is, what their real beliefs are. I see it as a kind of bait and switch con. And I think all of us go through rough patches in our lives. And when we do go through a rough patch over a death in the family, a marriage breaking up, losing our job, or for that matter, this pandemic right now that we're dealing with, COVID-19, we're anxious, we're looking for answers, and we're more easily persuaded than we would otherwise be. And you combine that with somebody you trust, somebody you care about, pitching for the group, acting as someone that introduces you to this group, and you have the formula for what can be a personal disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. I think there are some people out there who might really be immune to being in a cult. Like, if you took someone like Richard Dawkins, like famous atheist, who's just like, well, I think that guy would beat you back with a stick if you tried to snare him in some cult. But I get what you mean, that like, you can still be a very smart person, and especially if like one of your buddies comes up to you and tries to get you involved. I knew a guy who got into 2 separate cults, and he came from a military family, and he was in the military himself. And the first time around, the first cult that he joined, the way he found out that it was a cult was they told him that he had to break up with his girlfriend. And as soon as he did that, and he goes to his girlfriend, he goes, yeah, like, I have to break up with you. They told me that you're bad for me. And then she's like, wait a second. Like, what is this group that you're a part of? And they looked into it. And she's like, this is a cult. Like, he got out of it. And then, like, a few months later, he got sucked into the same thing. It's like, dude, like, you've been here before. How is it? Like, when you mentioned thought reform techniques, how can you take someone who has been in a cult, knows that they were in a cult, acknowledges it, and then just scoop them back up months later?
I think people that leave one group can bounce into another one. I've often called people like that cult hoppers, going from one group to another. I worked with a man who had been in one group called Ronthas School of Enlightenment, led by Jay-Z Knight, who claims to speak for a 35,000-year-old dead general from Atlantis. And he then bounced into this notorious group called Nexium, led by Keith Raniere, where ultimately Raniere was arrested because of his sexual proclivities. He had a sex slave group that was called DOS within Nexium. And he literally branded the flesh of women that were in the group. And he had a medical doctor that actually did this with a cauterizing iron. And when I work with this guy, he said to me, I don't ever want to bounce into another cult. I left one group. I got involved in a worse group, I think. And now I'm wondering, what's next? Am I going to bounce into yet another one? I mean, how do I not do that? And he ended up reading my book, Cults Inside Out, which is a compendium of information about destructive cults, including the history of many modern cults, beginning with Charles Manson and going through to today. And then also a breakdown of how these groups can be defined, how they can be understood, what their dynamics are, what their tricks are, and how they can play you. And I think if you understand all of that and you've sorted it out and you understand why the group is a destructive cult and what thought reform techniques they used on you and how this all came about, how they broke down your ability to critically and analytically evaluate things, and how they engendered dependency upon them to make value judgments for you. If you can kind of, you know, unpack that and look at that piece by piece, you understand the dynamics of a destructive cult. And if another group comes, you can say, hey, I've seen this before. I pick up on your approach and your pitch and some of the tricks I see you playing right now. And so you understand what makes them a destructive cult, and then you can avoid it. And I find people that bounce into another cult usually haven't sorted things out thoroughly.
Why does it seem like cults, almost always the cult leader is some like sex freak? Is that like, have you noticed that? Does that seem to be pretty routine in the cult world?
Well, I think what's routine is that the leader is an absolute authoritarian figure that has no meaningful accountability and becomes an object of worship. And so that's a lot of power, and it goes to the head, literally, of the leader. And to have that kind of power over people where you can basically ask them to do almost anything, to have that influence often leads to exploiting people. And one piece of that is sex. Another would be money. Another would be free labor. Another would be having, an extreme example would be having people commit criminal acts on your behalf, recruiting for you. And so basically, people are pawns and you are playing them. And when people have that kind of power, of course, it can become very intense, and they just feel that they can demand anything, get anything, and sex is frequently a demand that they make.
Going back to the thought reform techniques, you said that, you know, I understand you can get these in your book, but what are some of these thought reform techniques? What are some of the techniques that they would use on people, you know, the first meeting to getting you to be fully committed to the cult? How does that process happen? Did they just wear you down? Are they just really good marketers? How does that work?
Well, there are three seminal books that I would suggest people read, and I footnote them. My book has about 1,250 research footnotes as you read through. So, and there's an 18-page bibliography. So if you want to drill down, you can. But I would say the three primary building blocks to understand the type of coercive persuasion and thought reform that goes on in a destructive cult would be the book Coercive Persuasion by Edgar Schein, who taught at MIT, and the book Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism by Robert J. Lifton, a psychiatrist who taught at Harvard. And basically what Schein said was that there are three stages of coercive persuasion. First, you unfreeze the person psychologically and emotionally, and then you change them through the environment, and then you refreeze them. And I would put it like this: you break them down. you really create a lot of could be fear, anxiety, and you just break them down. And this is often done in an isolated setting where people are in a kind of bubble controlled by the group. And it can be days of a seminar, or it can be in a retreat. And then you use the peer pressure of the group to change people along with the pressure of the leader. And then three, you lock them in by isolating them in the group or through hyperactivity and isolation socially. You cut them off from people like the girlfriend, the family, other friends that are not in the group. You encourage them to spend all their time with the group, and you monopolize their time. Lifton, who wrote Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, called this milieu control, or control of the environment. And then also there is mystical manipulation or planned spontaneity. So you think that something is happening spontaneously when you're in the group, and really it's scripted. And a lot is going on that you don't understand, but that the group and the leader in particular understands, and you're being played and you do not know it. And you're at a distinct disadvantage in a situation like that, where the group and the leader know exactly what they're doing and you are kept in the dark. And then there's another book, it's called Influence, and it was written by Robert Cialdini. He's a psychologist who taught at Arizona State University. And his book Influence has sold more than a million copies. Cialdini basically came up with the six principles of influence. And one of them is liking. So you basically are subjected to love bombing in a destructive cult where everybody seems to like you. They tell you that they have unconditional love for you. But in reality, it's highly conditional upon you accepting the group and subordinating yourself to the group. And then Cialdini also talks about authority, that we respect and are more likely to agree with people who we perceive to be in authority. So many of these groups will cite the Bible, or they'll cite history or psychology or political science. Well-respected philosophers will be quoted in their synthesis, their composite belief system. And this is done because we respect authority, established authority. And so by invoking authority, they can get us to acquiesce, to give in, to go along with them. Those are a few things that give you a taste of how these groups operate.
What exactly distinguishes a cult from a religion? Like I went to a Catholic high school, and I remember at one point being in church my senior year, and we were reciting all the things we were supposed to recite, like. They would give you one of the communion hosts. They would go, lift up your spirit to the Lord. And you were supposed to reply, I lift my spirit up to the Lord with grace and, eat the crap. And I was thinking, this is, in another context, people would think this was really bizarre. You know what I mean? Like, so what exactly, at what point does a religion become a cult?
Well, I think it's not about what the group believes, it's about how the group behaves. So Robert J. Lifton wrote a paper that was published at Harvard some years ago, and he, I think, identified what I would call the nucleus for the definition of a destructive cult. And there are three core criteria that Lifton cited. One is that you have this absolute authoritarian leader that becomes an object of worship and who is the defining element and driving force of the group. So you have somebody like Jim Jones, David Koresh, Keith Raniere of NXIVM, L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology. And really the group is driven by that person, and they are answerable really to no one. And everyone is quoting them, whatever they say is right is right. Whatever they say is wrong is wrong. And they own it. They own the group. And then second, there is this process of indoctrination that has often been called brainwashing, which incorporates aspects of coercive persuasion, thought reform, and well-established influence techniques in a very intense way to, as I previously said, break people down, change them, and then convert them into a deployable pawn, as Margaret Singer, a well-known psychologist, once said. So then, and finally, is number three, the third criteria that Lifton cites, which is that the group is destructive. And this varies by degree from group to group. So you have some groups that are much more destructive than others. But that the group exploits people, and this can escalate to physical and sexual abuse, medical neglect, child abuse, criminal activity, and of course, in the worst case scenario, even death. So the groups that are called destructive cults can be defined as such, not by what their doctrine is or their philosophy, which is external. I would call that the outer shell, the facade, but rather by taking that away and looking at how the group is structured and its dynamics. And if you have those three criteria evident, the absolute authoritarian leader, that is the defining element and driving force of the group, an object of worship, the use of thought reform and coercive persuasion to gain undue influence, and then using that undue influence to exploit people to varying degrees, then you have what can be seen as a destructive cult.
I was saying, by that definition, then North Korea would be a destructive cult?
In my opinion, Kim and the North Korean family that has now, what is it now, the third generation of leaders from the family, they worship Kim, and they worshiped his father and his grandfather. Yes, in my opinion, North Korea would fit the criteria to be described as a destructive cult. And it's an example of how big a cult can actually be. I mean, North Korea is a substantial country, and frighteningly, they have nuclear weapons. And there is a religion, a mystical aura that revolves around Kim, that he is worshipped as like a god, even though he's a political leader.
And you had also mentioned in there the David Koresh, the Branch Davidians. That was the whole Waco travesty. And you were you somewhat involved in that? I know you had deprogrammed a couple Branch Davidians, correct?
Yes, I did. I deprogrammed two Branch Davidians, and then I also deprogrammed two other Davidians from another Davidian sect. There was more than one Davidian sect. The Davidians began as a peaceful group founded by Victor Howdiff, who established his community outside of Waco. And then there were splinters of the Howdiff original group. And then it went through Howdiff's widow after he died. And then a woman, Lois Roden, took over after her husband, George Roden Sr., died. He was a leader of the group that succeeded Victor Howdiff's widow. And then finally, when Lois Roden's health was failing, Vernon Howell, who later became known as David Koresh, he insinuated himself in the group and eventually took it over. In fact, he was tried for attempted murder when he tried to kill George Roden Jr., Lois Roden's son, in a bitter rivalry as to who would take control of the compound. So I had dealt with the Waco Davidians before the standoff for a number of years. I did two interventions, one before the standoff and one actually during the standoff. There was a young woman who was locked out, and her family had me work with her And both of the interventions were successful, and my other Davidian interventions were also successful. And when the BATF was investigating the Waco Davidians, they called me. I was part of that investigation. My testimony is cited in the Treasury report. And the young man that I deprogrammed, his affidavit was proffered to get an arrest warrant to be served on David Koresh. So I was involved fairly much historically. And then during the standoff, I worked for CBS News doing analysis regarding the 51-day standoff.
That whole Waco disaster had huge ramifications afterwards, because people got really mad at the ATF, and the Oklahoma City bomber claimed that he was motivated by Waco. I had read that some people had said they criticize you during that for saying maybe to humiliate David Koresh or something like that, like in terms of tactics. Does that ring a bell? What are people talking about with that?
Well, there have been many bizarre conspiracy theories and just flat lies told about my work dealing with the Waco Davidians. In fact, I advised the FBI to praise David Koresh. And I also advised them to quote scripture in a positive way. For example, I said that they should quote the scripture, "Suffer not the little children to come unto me," and cite Jesus's compassion for children as a bridge for Koresh to let children out of the compound. And they did that to some extent. I had disagreements with the FBI and their negotiators. I felt that the parents and the loved ones, the family members of people that were in the compound, their voices should be heard over the loudspeakers that the FBI set up, as opposed to rabbit screaming and music blaring, keeping them up all night. I said that was a really bad idea. And I said they needed their sleep, they needed to be well rested so they could think more clearly, and that they should have a kind of time during the day when different parents could speak to their family members using that loudspeaker system that the FBI set up. Because a key way that David Koresh controlled the thinking of the people in the compound was that they didn't hear their parents' voices unless he allowed it. He controlled the phones, communication, visits, and the people in the compound were very isolated and often had not seen their family for long periods of time.
Yeah, that seems like a terrible idea for the FBI to be blasting music to make them, basically put them even farther out of their minds. Like, seems like a very heavy-handed, ill-minded approach. And I'm glad that you told them that was a bad idea. At what point, when you, say, talk to those Branch Davidians and deprogram them, at what point do people come to you? Is it the people typically who are in the cults who wake up one day and go, oh my God, 30 teenage girls are all married to our dear leader. Something's wrong with this picture. Is it their doubts, or is it the doubts of their family member that call you and say, my son is wrapped up in this horrible, destructive cult? Or is there a typical process for how you get involved in these cases?
Well, I'm called or emailed. Someone will email me. Someone will call me, and they will say, look, my son, my daughter, my mother, my father, my spouse, my girlfriend, my boyfriend is involved in a very questionable, suspicious group. I think it might be a cult, and I've been reading your book, or I've been looking at culteducation.com online, and I'm beginning to see parallels between what's going on with my loved one and some of these historical accounts of destructive cults. And I'm thinking about an intervention. Of course, my book, Cults Inside Out, goes through what an intervention entails in great detail. And it has a chapter on assessment, a chapter on coping strategies, a chapter on how an intervention goes day by day. It typically takes 3 or 4 days. And so families gradually may come to a point where they decide, okay, I'm going to do something because I think this group is exploiting my loved one. I think that this could end up badly because of the beliefs of the group regarding abstaining from medicine. Maybe there's a issue of medical neglect, or it could be financial exploitation or sexual abuse, whatever. And so then I'm brought in to facilitate the intervention, and the family is there, much like a drug and alcohol intervention. And they talk about what their concerns are, why they wanted an intervention. And then I explain to the person, what is a destructive cult? What are the primary characteristics? What is thought reform and how does it work? And how might that be parallel to your group, to what's going on inside your group? And also, you know, what about the group is there in its history, in the history of the leader that you may not know that you should know before you decide to continue on with this group? So those are some of the things that you touch upon in an intervention in an effort to basically wake up the critical thinking and analytical ability of the person that you're working with. And you try to stimulate critical thinking and basically encourage them to think their way out of the group.
Okay, so it's mostly family members and loved ones. It's interesting because I talked to this psychologist who is an expert in terrorism, and he said that a lot of the people, in fact, most of the people who join terrorist groups at some point will think to themselves, like, this is, I don't believe in this at all. This is what am I doing here? This is not what I want my life to be. And I would imagine there's some parallel to people in cults. I mean, people have got to have some doubts at some point along the line where they look around and go, like, this doesn't make sense.
Well, yeah, I've been retained to do interventions with people from white supremacist groups, terrorist organizations. In particular, there was a young man, I write about him in my book. He was involved with a very fringy anti-abortion group, and he was planning on bombing clinics and killing doctors. And his family found out because they found his journal and they read it, and they saw suspicious activities. That is, he wasn't working, he was saving money for a purpose that was vague and unspecific. And they really suspected something was going on. And then they found the journal and they read what he was planning and they brought me in and we did an intervention. And I think we saved the lives of some people. And we also saved him the pain and suffering of being responsible for such horrible acts, as well as probably spending the rest of his life in prison.
And how old was that kid?
Well, he wasn't a kid. He was actually a military reserve officer with a college degree. He was in his 20s.
Wow. On the one hand, when I hear about that, I'm like, oh my God, like that guy should be in jail. But then on the other hand, I mean, how long ago was this? Has the guy lapsed into any acts of terror since you last spoke to him?
No, the intervention was in the 90s, and he went on to become a teacher, and he's had a very peaceful, reasonable life. I think at a point in his life, he came under the undue influence of a radical anti-abortion leader who encouraged him to violence. I mean, there was a period of time he lived in a basement, isolated from his family, isolated from everyone, except this leader. And he was, in my opinion, he was coercively persuaded to change his way of thinking. And you can see in his history, and you can see this in many destructive cult members that leave destructive cults, that their behavior in the group was an anomaly. In other words, they were violent in the group, and they were harsh, and they were judgmental, and they did things that their family thought this is not characteristic of who they are and their past history. And then when they left the group, they ceased to behave in that way. So you can see that behavior as an anomaly in their personal life. And the most obvious explanation is that that occurred due to the influence and the control of the group and the leader.
Yeah, that's, I mean, good for him. You know, I'm glad that, you know, maybe that speaks to sort of a softer, gentler approach that we should take as a society towards people who are in those kinds of mindsets. You keep mentioning the term destructive cult. Is there a particular reason for that? I mean, is there such a thing as a constructive cult, or is that just
I think the Grateful Dead had a cult following. People practically worshiped Jerry Garcia. I mean, they named an ice cream after him. And there was this following of the Grateful Dead that they were called the Deadheads. And they would follow the Grateful Dead on tour from venue to venue. And they just were completely caught up in the music and the philosophy of Jerry Garcia and the group. But I don't think the group really hurt people. And so I would see it as a benign cult. There was an architect by the name of Paulo Solare, and he created a philosophy called Arcology. And he built his own compound outside of Phoenix called Arco Sante. And people would come there, they would apprentice, they would live there. It was a community. Solare was very much this charismatic leader who was an object of worship, and people loved him. But I don't think he hurt anybody. So I think it is possible for a group to be a cult, to have a dominant charismatic leader, for that leader even to inculcate his or her ideas and indoctrinate people in a way that would be parallel to thought reform or coercive persuasion. But then that final third criteria is doing damage to people, exploiting them, hurting them. And I think you can have two out of the three, still have a group that could be called a cult, but would better be referred to as a benign cult if you use that word cult.
Wow. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I've only been to one Dead & Company show. Or did you ever check out the Grateful Dead while Jerry Garcia was still alive?
I was never a fan. And then after the Grateful Dead, after Garcia's death and things changed, and then some of those people followed the Fish, and you could say they were fish heads. But you know, there are people that can become very intensely devoted in a cult-like way to a person, a place, a thing, and they might be seen as a cult following, but not be a destructive cult. For the group to be considered destructive, it needs to be demonstrated objectively that it does harm, that it hurts people. And the groups that I deal with, that's typically abundantly clear.
Yeah, I mean, the Deadheads were not hurting anybody, but definitely a little culty. You know, people comparing, you know, I've been to 30 shows, I've been to 40. It's like, wow, like this is really big for you, huh? And it must be, nowadays, with the internet, it must be way easier to lure people into cults, right?
Well, I mean, talking about benign groups, you can also see CrossFit as a kind of cultish kind
True,
of
true.
thing, but not hurting people, getting people in shape, their soul cycle, very similar kind of thing. And you can even look at the Apple Corporation when Steve Jobs was alive as being a kind of personality cult. But rather than hurting people, he made quite a few people rich and built them their corporate headquarters, which was almost like an alternate world that Jobs created. But I would say ultimately he was relatively benign, and he was not a destructive cult leader. So I think you can see that in many different forms in the world around us. But sadly, there are a lot of just really destructive cults, and the internet, social media, all the platforms that are now available to these groups to recruit and reach out and grab people. And for that matter, you can actually construct a cult without meeting with people personally and do it online. And people can Skype with you. They can send you money through PayPal, and it just goes on and on.
Yeah, bet a lot of cults right now are doing their Zoom meetings, you know, getting those sessions in. That's the Steve Jobs thing is also a good example of a cult. I mean, he benign maybe, but also, I mean, the people who are jumping out the window in his factories, that's probably not entirely benign, right?
Well, I think you're talking about people in developing countries, people that are not working in Silicon Valley.
But at the manufacturing plant where the iPhones are being made in China, they literally had to install nets outside the factories because so many people were jumping off and killing themselves.
That has, you know, I've been to China a number of times, and that's an issue in China, is the working conditions for a lot of people and the stress. I wouldn't say it was only Apple. I would say it could be a number of factories, a number of different employers, and the feeling of hopelessness regarding housing, financial security, and the anxiety that people have in a country that has so many people and there's so much pressure to succeed.
So why do you think, looking back on what we've talked about here, why do you think that cults exist?
For the personal benefit of their leaders. I think you can see a cult leader as pretty much just a con man. The difference between a conventional con man and a cult leader is a conventional con man will run a scam on somebody, you know, the mark, as they say, and they get their money and they skip town and they move on to the next mark. With a cult leader, he or she will run the same con on the same people indefinitely. And so I see the cult phenomenon as something that will go on as long as there are people that want to make money this way, that want to exploit other people, take advantage of them, and make money this way. And I must tell you that many cult leaders are very rich. They're multimillionaires. They have enormous resources. For example, when L. Ron Hubbard died in 1986, that they knew of, he left an estate of $600 million. When Reverend Moon of the Unification Church died in his early 90s, a similar fortune of almost $1 billion was left behind. So there's big money to be made in this kind of a business. That is, if you don't have a conscience, or, you know, I think a sociopath, a psychopath, and you have little, if any, ability to have empathy or sympathy, and you're just out for yourself. And typically that's how cult leaders are. And they're very narcissistic and self-obsessed. And there are plenty of them, and it's a lucrative business model. Again, if you don't have any moral or ethical scruples.
Well, on that note, Rick Ross, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thanks, Duncan. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you to Rick Allen Ross, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.